Maybe someone like an eighth grade guidance counselor told you, you need to know what you want to do with your life. That determination can be a little tricky at age 13 or 14. It's not a whole lot easier for some people 10 years later. Today's guest and two friends found themselves in something like that position, so they hit the road in an RV. And that trip turned into their business, Road Trip Nation, which has now published a book, Roadmap, the Get It Together Guide for Figuring Out What to Do with Your Life. Nathan Nate Gebhardt is our guest. He's a co-founder of Road Trip Nation, along with Mike Mariner and Brian McAllister. They call Road Trip Nation a movement now, with public TV shows, web content, classroom curriculum materials, and now, of course, the book. Nate, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Hey, thanks very much for having me, Jeff.
Give us a sense of what was going on in your lives when you guys hit the road nearly 15 years ago.
Man, I guess to sum it up, it would probably be freaking out. I mean, I think each of us, Mike, Brian, and myself, we all realized that kind of at this particular moment, right as we were getting ready to graduate from college, that we were basically living the lives of somebody else, like the script of our parents, the script of society that said success is getting a fancy car or making a lot of money. You know, for me, I was really interested in, like, the creative pursuits, but the only, like, exposure I ever had to that was to painting. And so when I told my parents, like, oh, I want to be a painter, they, like, laughed at me, which was a totally appropriate response because I'm a really bad painter. But I had no experience to be like, well, like, I like creative. It could be these other things. And so I kind of listened to the noise of, like, artists are poor and they're homeless and they live under the boardwalk. And so I majored in business. And about the time when I was getting ready to graduate, I realized, like, this invisible assembly line that was kind of moving every single business major into, like, the track of becoming a consultant was just not who I was. It's kind of silly, but, like, the moment was realizing that consultants wear suits, and I can't wear a suit. I'm a t-shirt guy, and it was just a funny little bit of information that made me realize that I was just on the wrong path, and Mike and Brian had similar experiences, and so the idea was to just travel the country for 3 months and interview anybody that we could cold call and ask them how they figured it out, how they built a life around their interests.
And how did you decide which kinds of people did you want to just talk to, or pretty much anybody doing anything?
Well, I mean, I think it was a group of people that loved what they were doing. You know, we wanted to see how they unpacked their own story and what the decisions that they made to get there. Did they always know what they wanted to do? Did they have failures? Did they deal with risk taking? And it was anybody that kind of we came across that was living that, like, authentic life. So it was the director of Saturday Night Live. It was Wanda Sykes, it was Michael Dell, it was a cold call to the Supreme Court to interview Sandra Day O'Connor, Questlove to Howard Schultz, all these different eclectic people. But the thing they had in common was just they were building a life around their interests that really mattered to them.
And what did you find out from some of them, for example? I mean, I have read a bit about Questlove, for example, and I know that his parents encouraged his musical talents. But
right.
but it seems like so many other people probably faced what you faced, where they said, I want to do this. And some adult or all the adults in their lives said, what can you make a buck at, though?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think, like, I would first say, like, the most surprising, comforting and ultimately empowering thing that we really learned was that everybody has had this noise in their life. Everybody has had those moments of doubt, of confusion. You know, we I think put people up on pedestals and assume that their life was like this straight line to success. You know, you look at Questlove and you think, man, this guy's just a great musician, but you don't realize, like, the guy works like 18-hour days every single day. You look at Richard Linklater, who is the director of Boyhood, and when he told his parents he wanted to be a filmmaker and a writer, the best they could say is, like, we don't do that. You could maybe write children's books, but, like, we're not writers. You look at JetBlue and you think, oh, wow, like, the David Neeleman, the man that founded that, he must have just really always had success, but he was fired as a vice president of Southwest Airlines. Howard Schultz from Starbucks, he was his first in his family to go to college, and he was donating blood to have enough money to eat in college.
Wow. So everybody went through some tough stuff.
Yeah.
The name you mentioned, Richard Linklater. I'm familiar with his story as well, and you bring it up again in the book. But he really had a plan for himself and realized that he needed to kind of draw back materialistically for a while to be able to do it, because it sounds like he got himself into a situation where he was living very cheaply and spent that time watching a lot of movies and reading a lot.
Yeah, I mean, Richard's probably a unique case, which is he really did know what he wanted to do, and he wanted to be a filmmaker. I would say the vast majority of the people had an inkling about the thing that they were interested in. But to finish Richard's story, Richard literally decided, I want to be a filmmaker. I know nothing about it. I have no money. So he worked at an offshore oil rig for an entire year, basically living like on making no expenses, just working on the rig. And that savings allowed him to basically take the next entire year and just learn about filming. And he just like holed himself up in an apartment and read every book and bought cameras and taught him the act of filmmaking. But I think the vast majority of the people really didn't know what they wanted to do. And I think one of my favorite examples is Jill Soloway. At the time we interviewed her, she was a writer for 6 Feet Under, and she's gone on to do a number of things, including created and directed the TV series Transparent. And when she was really pressed and trying to figure out what she wanted to do, one of her friends was like, well, just like, what do you care about? And the best answer that she could get, the most honest answer, was the Brady Bunch.
So, really?
Yeah.
And Transparent, if anybody's seen this series, and I have, it's a family, for sure, but not at all like the Brady Bunch.
No, but the Brady Bunch was the thing that she loved, and so she was kind of chasing this definition of success, like society's, like, generalized definition of success. She was doing the things that you were supposed to do, but the Brady Bunch was this little break, and she said, you know, what if I just want to write a play and of an episode of the Brady Bunch and get my friends to act it out on stage. And that play became the thing that really turned her confidence into the ability of saying, oh, I can write, I can do something.
We'll talk more about the people that the guys from Road Trip Nation met along the way. Nate Gebhardt is here to talk about the book Roadmap, the Get It Together Guide for Figuring Out What to Do With Your Life. We will rejoin the interview here on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Nate Gebhardt and two buddies got out of college and didn't quite know what the next step should be. So the three of them, Nate, Mike Mariner, and Brian McAllister, took off in a green RV, not just to find themselves, but also to find out how other people handled the questions of what to do with our lives. That became a business, Road Trip Nation, with documentaries on PBS and a website and curriculum content. And in 2015, they published a book, Roadmap, the Get It Together Guide for Figuring Out What to Do With Your Life. Nate joined us in April of 2015. There are some phone calls from the original interview, but because this is pre-recorded, we can't take any new phone calls or emails today. So where did you guys get the RV, Nate?
The RV was kind of a funny thing in the sense that we had no money, and we knew that we wanted to travel because people were interesting everywhere. And so we also knew we couldn't afford hotels or anything like that. So the RV became the way in which we knew we could have a transportation and living in the same quarters. But, I worked for months to try and get an RV sponsored and had this big vision of getting a really nice fancy RV that would actually drive and, not break down. And that never worked. The best we could do was, Brian's parents were donating their RV as a tax write-off, and we just decided that we would buy off their tax write-off. And so we bought his parents' RV that they've been road tripping in for years, painted it bright green with paint from Home Depot. It was a 1985 RV. It broke down in every single city. We have a lot of affection for it, but at the moment it was pretty difficult.
Is there any significance to the color green?
I think it was on sale at Home Depot, probably.
It was cheap.
It was cheap, but you couldn't go yellow. It's a school bus. You couldn't go red. It's a fire truck, and black would be a little dark.
All right. So how far along into into that first road trip, did you figure out, and believe me, I can imagine it would be a little tougher to figure out, this is what we should keep doing after the thing broke down a few times. But at some point, you guys had to say, well, why don't we just keep doing this?
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. It was really clear probably 2 weeks into the trip. The trip was 3 months long. So 2 weeks in, we started to just realize that these conversations that we were having, they weren't like the normal like interviews that we would read in a magazine. It was really like deep down, like heartfelt conversations with people talking about their struggles. And I think even almost every single interview we left going, oh my gosh, my friend Trevor or my friend Sam, or, you know, all, the community around us back in college at the time needed to hear these stories. And so it wasn't that we had this business plan or we had this idea of what it would manifest into. We just knew that we had to commit ourselves to sharing these stories and sharing these experiences. And so, you know, 14 years later, we're season 13 in our public television series, and now this new book coming out.
And so did the mission evolve quickly, or are you pretty much doing what you did at the beginning?
Well, I mean, I guess I would say the manifestation evolved. We didn't expect to have a curriculum, so we have a curriculum now that's been used by over 140,000 students, primarily at-risk students, trying to find their passion. We didn't expect to be writers or filmmakers. We didn't even know how to use a camera until 3 days before the trip. So it was very much this evolution. But like I said, I think we were just so committed to sharing the stories, and however we best could do that was kind of where we evolved the brand.
The first name of one of the leaders that you talked to in here is John Perry Barlow. Where did you meet him, and what was his story?
We met him at his house, actually, crossing the country. He is really an interesting individual. So J.P. Barlow he was a rancher, cattle rancher. He wrote songs for the Grateful Dead, and he co-founded the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And I think there's like a few moments in that interview that I just like absolutely love. The first is his kind of just disarming piece, and he says, you know, this idea that we're supposed to figure out our life, you know, he pushed back on that and said, you know, life isn't gettable. Like, the sooner you get comfortable with the idea that we are all collectively trying to figure this out, the sooner you'll be more at peace with yourself. But there is no manual, and it's not something that you just, like, fill in the right bubbles and all of a sudden the door unlocks.
But that's an interesting concept. So it's not just an individual thing. I mean, the fact is you can kind of find a place for yourself in a world with lots of other people in it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that was a sense of community that we found on the road in every one of these conversations. And I think the other thing that was just reassuring, too, that he said was, you know, you're not much of an explorer if you're not lost. And I think that that's such an important piece, because we have to give ourselves permission to be lost in order to kind of find that next version of ourselves.
Nate Gebhard's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the co-founder of Road Trip Nation, out with a book now called Roadmap. Here's Connie and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
I have a question that about the concept that especially this younger generation is actually going to be able to go for their dreams because of the problem student debt load.
Right.
I just see this enormous amount of debt loads. I talk to people, and that includes even people my age or a little bit younger. I'm a baby boomer. I mean, many of us came out of college with relatively little debt loan, and we're able to, in some senses, hit the road and really enjoy ourselves and discover ourselves. And as it's progressed over these 40 to 50 years, now we have $25, $50, $100,000 in debt load for people coming out. And how does that burden, I see it burdening people in my generation and those youngers and all their life choices, because that debt load is behind them all the time. So that's the concern I have about trying, even having people being able to go for what they want to do instead of what they have to do to pay off those loans.
Yeah, very, very valid point to bring up. Thanks for that, Connie. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Connie. I think there's kind of two perspectives to that. I think there is the individuals that are already in the state of massive debt, Mike being one of those, one of our co-founders. And it's you're absolutely right that if you've already found yourself in that situation, your opportunities are more confined. You can't just kind of say, well, I'm going to go volunteer at NPR for a year like Jad Abumrad did from Radiolab and make no money because you've got those loans. But it's not to say that you can't evolve and get closer into the things that you're interested in. So you might have gone to school and racked up that debt to be a lawyer, but what you really love is sports. You know, it doesn't mean abandon it and try to become a professional basketball player, but maybe you're moving from being a traditional attorney to a lawyer within a sports agency, or a lawyer for the Diamondbacks. So, you know, with that debt burden, you've got more constraints. But I think the other piece, and I think the generation that's coming up, is really rethinking that value of education, and they're thinking about what's the right investment. And there are certainly occupations that require that education. You know, being a lawyer or a doctor is one of those that you do have to make that huge upfront investment. But something like a web programmer or a graphic designer, you know, I think more and more we're seeing that employers really care about your skills as opposed to, you know, where you got that degree. So I think it's pretty more scrutiny onto whether or not and how we pursue our education, and knowing that there are so many new and different resources out there that kind of ripping off Ben Franklin's quote, all education is self-education. And I think what we're seeing is a lot of these kind of different collaborative ways to kind of gain experience, whether it's lynda.com or General Assembly.
So, you know, I haven't established yet if you had ended up doing yourself, Nate, what your parents thought you would end up doing, what would you be doing?
Oh, man, I know exactly what it was. The suit and tie story was literally what my path was at going down. I was interested in art design. I listened to that noise. I majored in business, and every single business major that I knew was becoming a consultant. And at the time, I had subscribed to this kind of idea that I think so many of us get into, which is that there's this universal definition of success, and that is, you know, get the nice house, get the fancy car, the 2.5 kids, and I totally, like, blindly was accepting that there's a uniform definition of success, and I'm going to chase that, and it was chasing it through becoming a consultant. And you know, it was silly, but not until I realized that, like, being a consultant required wearing a suit and tie, did I actually rethink who I was and what was important to me. And I think probably one of the most significant things we found on the road was that people who found their authentic selves decided to define success on their own terms.
Not somebody else's terms.
Exactly.
All right, which gets us into self-construction. I'll get to that point in just a moment. Our guest is Nate Gebhardt, one of the founders with Mike Mariner and Brian McAllister of Road Trip Nation, now in its 13th season on PBS, and now creating a book called Roadmap, the Get It Together Guide to Figuring Out What to Do with Your Life. So self-construction, this is making your own thing, not letting somebody else make a construct of you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that was very much an intentional part to this book. So in the past, we've kind of just said, you know, here's a road trip, here's a bunch of interviews, you know, take with it what you may. But with Roadmap, we really wanted to kind of create a framework that any reader could take and make their own, that wasn't prescriptive, that didn't kind of give a false hope of do these five steps and your life will be perfect. Because the truth is, we've seen countless individuals completely successful still say, oh, I'm still trying to figure it out. And I think we kind of review the process by which people define their own roads in life is this part of this act of self-construction. And that's kind of the framework for the book. It's broken up into let go, define, become.
You know, it's interesting to think, though, in terms of people, and I can relate to these people who think, well, okay, give me just one or two choices and I'll work with those. People who, in other words, can be freaked out or unglued by the openness of it all. And then in the second sentence of chapter one, you mentioned cringing at the line, you can be whomever you want to be. Why cringe?
Because it sounds so cheesy. that's why. But it is the truth. You know, I mean, I think the idea that we have to kind of follow this kind of script is really easy sometimes, because we can kind of say, okay, well, I'm doing everything right. I'm being successful outwardly. And we don't kind of give ourselves that freedom to think broadly. But I think what we've really seen is that if you're pursuing your interests, you really can find a livelihood around those. You can be whoever you want to be, obviously with some very obvious exceptions. But it's about giving yourself the freedom and the flexibility to be authentic to yourself and following those interests, as opposed to kind of reverse engineering your way into an occupation.
Which means resisting something you brought up earlier, the invisible assembly line, which sounds like you're trying to satisfy other people by moving on to this path and just getting chugged through. And in your case, it would have led to a consultancy and a suit.
Yeah, and I think that's the scary thing. Like, when I reflect on my life, I probably would have been a decent consultant. Like, the topics kind of interested me. But it just wasn't true to, like, who I really am. Like, the desires to solve problems are fun, but I'd rather solve those in the context of design or creativity as opposed to business and management. And so I think the scarier thing was that I was about to be outwardly successful but inwardly hollow. And I would have done that had I not stopped and questioned myself.
And one of the major points you make, too, in the book, you guys, is that it's not about deferring things. Like, I'll get to that later. I mean, frankly, that's where I got, and I still haven't worked for Amtrak and worked on passenger trains. But, you know, what the heck, you know. But it was one of those deals where you get out of school and you look at the crushing debt that we talked about with Connie just a little bit ago, where you think, well, I really can't do exactly what I want to do right now. But you're turning that on its head.
Yeah, I mean, yes and no. I mean, I think we're acknowledging that that change is difficult, and it really depends on kind of where you're at in your life. You know, there's the bold change that sounds sexy and works great in a movie when somebody just abandons their life and starts anew. And, you know, we've certainly interviewed a fair share of those people, like Jimmy Chin, who's a National Geographic photographer, who decided he was going to live in his car and take photographs and climb mountains. And he did that for 9 years. And Ben Younger, the filmmaker who did Prime and The Boiler Room, you know, he volunteered one day on a film set and quit his high-paying job as a campaign manager in New York. But the vast majority of the people didn't do that kind of movie star approach. They took incremental steps. So, like, looking at Tinker Hatfield, who's the vice president of design at Nike and innovation, like, he's designed all of Michael Jordan's shoes. He's a huge player at Nike. But he was an architect. And he was an architect who came from a family of sports, who loved sports himself. But his way into sports was lateral. He said, I'm going to take architecture. And then he went to Nike and designed their buildings. And that was his door to then drill down into the thing that he really found interesting, which was design and products and shoes and sports. And so he really mashed up his life as this kind of incremental approach, kind of architecture for a sporting company, then design. And it was this kind of step-by-step piece.
And he certainly challenged some assumptions along the way. Instead of building up to building buildings, he started there and came back to where he wanted to be.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. Like, you look at, like, Craig Robinson, who is a comedian. He was on The Office. Like, people don't realize that, like, he was a successful teacher. He has his master's in education. And even though he wanted to do comedy, he had this day job that he continued in until, after lots of determination, he was gaining enough success to leave that full-time job. You know, Wanda Sykes worked at NSA.
Really?
Yeah, she was at the NSA doing comedy at night, and only after years of kind of grinding did that comedy into her, did her skills kind of match her interest to the point where she could abandon the NSA. But, you know, she was very incremental and methodical in her approach.
Now, I should point out that the Approachian roadmap is not just a do your own thing whenever you want to kind of thing. There are exercises in here and things to fill out, and you even have the where will I be in 5 years, where will I be in 10 years, where will I be in 15 years exercise. This is one of the few places where you begin to look a little bit like what color is your parachute, but exercises can really freak people out, though, when they're forced to think about these things.
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, we had a pretty amazing writing team on this book. It wasn't just Mike, Brian, and myself. And, you know, the different personalities of this book, of the writers, came into play. Some of us love exercises. Some of us would never do an exercise because it sounds cheesy. I think the point of the questions in the book isn't to force somebody to write and scribble on the page. It's to get somebody to think about it. And so when you go through a flow chart of what the noise is, you know, that's kind of like a riff off of Wired Magazine's flow charts. And if you look at kind of the projects that we have in the back of the book, it's to stimulate action. You know, we really want this book to be a tangible resource, not just that, like, silly gift that you get at graduation and then you just kind of throw it away. You know, this should be a book that, like, you write in, you tear apart, you throw against the wall, you set it down. And then when you're asking yourself that question of what am I going to do in my life, you pick it back up and you go through that process of let go, define, become again. So we really hope it's an active and valuable pursuit as opposed to just a cutesy little graduation gift.
Nate Gebhardt, Mike Mariner, and Brian McAllister are the creators of Road Trip Nation and the authors of Roadmap, the Get It Together Guide for Figuring Out What to Do with Your Life. Nate joined us in 2015. The interview continues in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Three guys just out of college wondered what to do next. They got into a green RV and started across the country. Over time, it became what they did next. They started the business Road Trip Nation, and that led to the book Roadmap, the Get It Together Guide for Figuring Out What to Do with Your Life. Nate Gebhardt joined us in April 2015, and because the interview is recorded, we're not taking any new phone calls or emails today. You mentioned that it's not just the three of you guys, the original founders, working on the book. You have a team now. How big is the whole Road Trip Nation operation?
We are just about 50 people. We have a for-profit that does the television show and the video-based interview archive, and then we have a nonprofit that does all of our curriculum in the primarily at-risk communities.
50 people altogether, and is there still just one RV on the road? Are there multiple RVs?
No, we kind of have an RV buying problem. We have, I think, seven. There's probably four in good working order. We're probably in a total count of like 10. We've had RVs in Australia and New Zealand. So, yeah, we're pretty comfortable with painting RVs green, which we still do with house paint.
Really? You still go to Home Depot and get
Yeah, it's just, you just roll it on. It sticks just fine.
Wow. I've had it come off of metal before. I don't know if you ran into the same situation. You got to use the right kind of paint, I guess.
Yeah, we just sand the metal. Yeah. It's pretty ghetto, but it suits us just fine.
You were talking just a little bit about the noise, and who provides the noise in this context?
I mean, I think the way we really define the noise is that it's any kind of pressure from the outside that doesn't take into account your own individuality. And a perfect example of that is this amazing man named Gerard Baker. We interviewed him. He's the first Native American superintendent for Mount Rushmore. He started in the Park Service cleaning toilets and worked his way all the way up. And he recounted this really touching story of being, I think it was like the day before his graduation, he went to a Catholic school, and a nun came up to him right before he graduated and said, I think maybe with like sincerity, you know, the best you can do is get a good job pumping gas. And that's like the perfect, like, heartbreaking example of the noise. And we all have that. You know, I think some people are told the only appropriate career you can have is to be a doctor or a lawyer. And other people are told, you're never going to be smart enough to be a lawyer. You're never going to be capable of being a doctor. And noise is different and unique for everyone, but we all get it.
And there are some other great examples in there, too. The person who's told, oh, you want to be a drummer? What are you going to do with that? Well, he's one of the guys who founded the Blue Man Group. Mm-hmm. And then the girl who was told, oh, surfing is for boys, and she's now a champion female surfer. So
Yeah. All
kinds of examples of bad advice in the noise section. Let's take a call here. Here's Wolfgang in Sunny Valley. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Nate Gebhardt, one of the many authors of Roadmap.
Good morning. That noise thing is actually tying into what I was going to ask. I mean, my life has been not according to plan. My parents didn't tell me in order to be the right person, you have to do A, B, C. They let me do what my heart told me to do. So, and you also mentioned your Catholic school, right? Mm. So my question is, to what extent... And you also were talking about the five steps to such and such, right? That's
right.
Noise.
Right.
That's potentially noise. But there is a seductive factor to that. So that, in a way, the promise of if you follow the instructions, you will be successful or right, or you will get to go to heaven, you know? So to that extent, do not patriarchal religions, all of them in a way, try to sell this five steps, Ten Commandments, whatever it is, to being the right person to fulfill your destiny instead of saying, what is your destiny? Find it.
Mm-hmm. So instead of you getting a chance to discover it for yourself, it's somebody saying, follow this path. And that is certainly something you're resisting here, Nate.
Yeah, I mean, I think what comes to mind is, follow your path. I think the another phrase that I cringe at is follow your passion. And I think it has this really strong connotation to a young person or say anybody who is trying to figure it out, which is like, oh my gosh, this passion is this huge, huge thing that I have to figure out. It's got to be like the one thing, like the one right husband or wife, partner. It's got to be it's likely got to give back to society. And I think it forces us to kind of get stuck in paralysis. And the idea that we've really seen is that passion is kind of that end result of taking lots of incremental steps. And those steps are kind of pursuing your interest, seeing what's there, exploring where your skills match up, likely failing often. You know, there's a tremendous amount of failure in almost every single, well, I wouldn't say almost, I would say every single person that we interviewed had a tremendous amount of failure. And nothing is guaranteed. That's an absolute. And it's also to say, like, it's going to be hard, and I think likely kind of doing work that really drives you, you end up working harder. It's just that it doesn't feel like work in the normal connotation. It's that it drives you further to excel and further to succeed. But I think the scary thing is not trying, is not going in those actions, and is actually getting into a job where you spend more time figuring out how to not work than actually work.
There's a cool concept here, the dash. Can you explain what is meant by the dash?
Yeah, this amazing man who was very deeply involved in jazz. He talked about what you see on everybody's tombstone, and you see your birth date, the dash, and the end date. And he talked about what really matters is the dash on that tombstone. How did you spend your life? And it goes to, I think, a lot of the heart of the questions that or the conversations that we have with these individuals, which is, when you've got young people, because every road trip we do is, we were only on the first road trip, and every other road trip has been other young people asking these older people to reflect on their life. They often get to the place of saying, what really drove me is I didn't want to come from a perspective of I wish I would have, I wish I could have. They really wanted to look at that dash and say, I made the choices that I felt confident in, and some of them worked and some of them didn't, but at least I tried.
And that goes into the point of building a life and not a resume. I mean, you're not just trying to impress anybody else. You're really just trying to do what feels good for you. Are you consciously saying, money shouldn't matter as much as what it is that you're doing?
Well, I think money definitely matters, but it's a means to an end. It's not an end in and of itself. I think countless people that we've interviewed, once they are making enough money to subsist, additional money doesn't make them much happier. You know, we interviewed this amazing woman who was a lawyer, Charlene Gibson, and she was a pretty successful lawyer in Manhattan, a corporate lawyer. And she got to this place where she just literally was sitting there with tremendous outward success, but just really feeling not fulfilled. And she remembers saying to herself, like, what am I supposed to do, like, on a weekend or something? She's like, what, am I supposed to just go out and buy stuff until I die? And I think, you know, it's important to really think about, like, what is success to you? What matters to you? You know, David Neeleman, the founder of JetBlue, said, success to me is mattering. Christina Heinegger, who's an outdoor consultant, said, you know, what success is to me is joy. And I think over and over again, when people really think about it, as long as we're subsisting, as long as we're able to support our families, more money isn't more happy. It's more or less really, what is it that drives you, and what do you want to, you know, how do you want to fill that dash? And more often than not, it's matter, it's joy.
The there's an interesting section here that really has less to do with the whole search for meaning in life than getting along with people on the road. And I gather you guys got some static, at least some looks anyway, from fellow RVers out on that first road trip.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're often in RV parks, and though we don't park in them all the time. But it's interesting in the sense that RVs are generally something that is that aspirational thing that, you know, I'll work this job that I hate, save up enough money, and then I'll buy that RV, retire, and go live my life. And this idea that you can, that we have to compartmentalize our life, we do work to satisfy an income, and then we have our life, whether it's a weekend warrior life or it's a deferred kind of plan of retirement. It's a scary one. You're never guaranteed to live to, you know, retirement age. And I think that's been something that's really important to us. We interviewed this amazing man named Randy Komazar, who wrote a book called The Monk and the Riddle, and he very much talked about this deferred life plan and the idea that it's very acceptable in society to just work in a job that you hate. You know, Gallup did this study in the workforce and found that 70% of the people employed are not engaged in the work that they do. And so if you look at, like, the resources that, like, are creating that statistic, like, definitely something needs to change. And I think the vast majority of the people that are unhappy probably pursued a path similar to the one I was on, which is we're kind of identifying this occupation because it makes money or it looks prestigious, but it doesn't really align with our soul, but we'll live that deferred life plan. And the people that we interviewed and those that changed my life and the other road trippers, they really chose to pursue their interests and to evolve those interests into their own life and to create an authentic life completely through and through, not just compartmentalized on the weekends.
Many inspiring stories and many steps in terms of figuring out what we might do to be able to find inspiration within ourselves as well. Contained within the book Roadmap, the Get It Together Guide for Figuring Out What to Do with Your Life, a production of Road Trip Nation, founded by Nate Gebhard and his classmates Mike Mariner and Brian McAllister. Nate, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Hey, thank you so much, Jeff.